Well, there's a Sunday school song. If you were raised in Sunday schools, you might be familiar with it. Goes, I won't sing it, but I'll say it. The lyrics are, He lives, Christ Jesus lives today. He walks with me and talks with me along life's narrow way. He lives, salvation to impart. You ask me how I know he lives within my heart. That's the song, and to my mind, lovely though that song may be, it captures the problem, I think, for both Christians and atheists when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus. Because there you have a list of, subjective human experience that he lives, Christ Jesus lives today. There's the claim, he walks with me and talks with me along life's narrow way. There's the evidence. Then you ask, have you got any further evidence? And the Christian says back to the inquirer, I know he lives because he lives within my heart. And that may have been good enough for a lot of people, but I don't think it's good enough for atheists and agnostics who have serious and good questions about these things. And I actually don't think it's good enough for the New Testament vision of Christian faith. Because the New Testament never says to a believer, and Christians, I think, ought never say to an atheist or a skeptic, the only grounds for believing in the resurrection of Jesus is a subjective feeling within my heart. And in actual fact, as I want to say in the brief time we've got today, the New Testament and what it says about the resurrection of Jesus is just not like that. I want to think about the resurrection of Jesus, and in doing so, we're thinking about claims related to a particular set of events that happened, most likely on the 7th of April, between 12 at midnight and about 4 a.m., in the year 33 AD under the reign of Tiberius, Caesar of the Roman Empire. I want to ask the question, what happened, and think about how we can know what happened on that date, at that time, in a certain place, in a cemetery, just inside the gates of Jerusalem. Let me just set it up with a bit of background, which I think is important for understanding the events that we're thinking about. The two relevant cultures for those events on the 7th of April, 33 AD, in Jerusalem, are the Jewish culture and the Greco-Roman culture. Israel at the time was part of the Roman Empire, which had itself inherited the Greek culture and appropriated it as its own. And the point is that neither of those cultures, neither the Jewish culture nor the Greco-Roman culture, had within it any prophecies or beliefs that would lead anyone to expect that a man would walk out of his grave, having been dead, now being made alive. So the Greek culture had no tradition of resurrection in it at all. The Greeks either believed in annihilation, that you would just cease to exist at the time of your death, or they had a kind of murky, you wouldn't even call it hope, more of a murky sense that perhaps you went like Homer to the underworld, or like in the Odysseus, that you went somehow to the underworld and there was a murky kind of spiritual post-mortem existence. No one in the Greco-Roman world believed in resurrection. And if you told anyone in the Greco-Roman world about resurrection, they would think it was a bad idea. Because the whole thing of Greco-Roman thought was to escape from the limitations of a physical human body. The Jewish people, of course, did have a belief in resurrection. Not all of them believed in it. So the Sadducees, those who ran the temple, did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. The Pharisees and the Zealots did, based on their understanding of the Old Testament and certain key passages within it. But none of them had any belief that a man would rise from the dead. Their belief was that at the end of time, their God would come and vindicate them and judge the world and raise people up for their judgment. It was never a part of anyone's belief, any Jewish person's belief, that a man, let alone the Messiah, would be raised to life again. That just wasn't on the map as something that anyone was expecting. Which is why, when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus, it's the first recorded claim of such a thing in history. No one ever made it up because no one expected it to happen. And in fact, the resurrection of Jesus created as many problems as it solved for first century Jewish belief, let alone for Greco-Roman belief. That's the background, I think, to the evidence that we're considering in the brief time we've got. As we turn to the evidence, if you ask the question, what sort of evidence do we have? The answer is actually quite a lot. In terms of the kind of evidence that you have for historical events, which is largely given over to documentation, we have a lot of documentation to do with Jesus, and a fair bit to do with his resurrection in particular. The one people are always interested in is in the non-Christian sources. We want to know, are there any non-followers of Jesus that talk about Jesus? And most certainly there are. There are a good dozen sources from Greek people, or Greco-Roman people, and from Jewish non-Christians, Josephus, Tacitus, Pliny the Elder, the Talmud, and so on, that talk about Jesus. And in fact, if you did the exercise and said, could you write a life of Jesus and not use anything ever written by a Christian, you'd have a pretty decent little outline. You would know that he was born under dubious circumstances. You would know that he was a miracle worker and or sorcerer. You would know that he had many followers, that he was crucified, and you would know that his followers believed him to have been raised from the dead. You would get all that from non-Christian sources. But the truth of the matter is that most of the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus in terms of literary sources comes from Christians, and in particular comes from the Bible. And again, there's a myth to explode here. Well, two myths, really. The first one is that when you say the Bible, you're just talking about one thing, that the Bible stands historically as one source, that it counts for one. And the second is that if you're interested in your topic, you can't possibly report accurately on your topic. So the second one first, that just because you're interested in your topic, you can't be accurate about your topic. That's a rule that's applied to the Bible, and as far as I can see, is applied to nothing else in the world of literature. So, for example, if you read a biography of Shane Warne, and as you read it, you're getting into it, and you put it down, and you notice on the back, it turns out that Tony Gregg is interested in cricket. And you're like, oh my goodness, I can't read another page, because it turns out that the guy that I'm reading has an interest in the topic that he's speaking about. Of course not. In fact, if you excluded people from writing about things that they were interested in or believed in, you would vastly reduce anything being written about anything, because that's why 80-90% of books are written, because you were interested. The only exception is your year 10 book, your year 10 essay review on terms of endearment or whatever, which you resented precisely because you had to write it and you weren't interested in it. Everything else apart from the stuff you have to write at school, you write because you're motivated. And the Bible is just like that. Of course the people that write in it are interested in their topic. That may raise certain questions for you about how they slant things, and you might want to test what they say against other things and compare it against other evidence, just like anything. But it doesn't for a moment exclude those sources as useful or interesting. On the contrary. The second one, which is just really a trap for young players, is the idea that the Bible is just one source. That's just not true. It's confusing because Bible is a singular word. But the Bible is a book of 66 books with many authors over many years. It's a library that's held together in a bounded codex. And when it comes to Jesus, and particularly to his resurrection, this will get technical for about 1.5 minutes. You've got your main sources are Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Paul. They're the main sources for the resurrection of Jesus. Now, to break that down a bit, you've already got five sources there, although three of them, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are what scholars call the Synoptic Gospels. The word S-O-N, S-Y-N, comes from, we have the word synagogue, which means drawn together, sin, and optic, from which you get opticians or optic fibres and so on, that means to see together. So the Matthew, Mark and Luke are Gospels that see together. And if you read them, they sound like they've been drinking from the same juice or rolling together on the same path. So they're the three that stand together. John has been very much paddling his own canoe, and then Paul we'll talk about at the end. But with Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the three Gospels, you've got to get used to the idea that in the Bible, unlike our books, you name the book after the author, so the book's called the author. Within Matthew, Mark, and Luke tells us that he called on many sources to compile his gospel. So his gospel, like most of them, written somewhere between the 50s and the 70s, or maybe 80s at the latest, called on many other sources and eyewitnesses to compile their accounts. And in particular, the Gospels of Matthew and Luke use Mark and use another source which scholars call Q. So stick with this. You've got to imagine that Matthew and Luke, writing their Gospels, have on their desk the Gospel of Mark, which they've got access to, and another book called Q, which Mark does not have access to. So you can imagine how you'd work that out. You see Matthew and Luke quoting from this same source that Mark doesn't seem to have access to. And then you have Matthew, who quotes from a source that scholars call M, because it's unique to him. Neither Q nor Mark nor Luke have access to that. And there's another source called L, which is just all the stuff that Luke has that no one else has. So see, even within those three Gospels, you've got at least five or six independent witnesses to the things that are being talked about. And in a way that's kind of awkward for Christians, but very pleasing for history departments, you have multiple attestations that go back early, they go beyond, because obviously if Luke is interviewing someone in the 70s, he's interviewing someone about things that happened well before that. You have these things pulled together, and they awkwardly don't always flush in the way you might like them to. So there's some genuine confusion as you look about it. It's which Mary was where that morning? And were there three or four Marys? And which house was she staying in? And how did she get there that quickly? And the other guy got there. Why? Well, it's annoying for Christians, especially on the more fundamentalist end, because you want it to all work perfectly. But it's exciting for historians because you know that they didn't all get together in a room and say, let's make sure this all matches. And for a historian, that is great, because the moment that you feel things rubbing up against each other, you know that you're dealing with people that didn't get together and iron out all the difficulties, aka you know you're dealing with genuine historical sources. So that's the kind of thing we're dealing with. And then finally, I mentioned Paul. You might say, why would you mention Paul as a source? Because he doesn't write a biography of Jesus in the way that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do. But for historians, that's precisely the point. The great thing about Paul, well, the two great things, is that he's earlier than those guys. His first letter is in about 48, 49 AD, and Jesus dies in 30, 33. He's very close to the events that he's talking about. But even better than that, he writes about them accidentally rather than on purpose. And historians love that. So historians, if someone's writing a life of Jesus, they take that seriously, but there's all sorts of ways they might be making things sound like the author wants them to sound. But the thing about Paul is that he never writes a biography, he just writes letters to churches. And he writes to the church in Corinth, not because he wants to tell them the story of Jesus, but because they're doing all sorts of ridiculous things that Christians should never do. And yet in that letter, Paul provides us with a wealth of historical details about Jesus by accident. So I'm going to put it this way. If in 100 years you found a poster that said, Rory speaking on the resurrection in the city at 12 o'clock on whatever day it is today, that's one line of evidence, and that's pretty good, and a historian's going to think, okay, that probably happened. But if a historian also hacked my Gmail account and found an email from me to my wife saying, hey, baby, I'll be home a bit later tonight. I've just got to go get that milk, like you said, and then I've got to drop into so-and-so, and I had a talk today, and that went okay, but my voice was a bit croaky. Historians would love that, because I didn't set out to defend the fact that I was here. I mentioned it incidentally. Does that make sense? And that's why Paul is taken the most seriously by historians, because all his evidence is there by accident. Well, they're the sources. What do we make of the claims? The claim is that on the 7th of April, thereabouts, 33 AD, some followers of Jesus, first the women, then the men, got to the tomb in which he was buried and found it empty. And then subsequently, over a period of 40 days, Jesus appeared to, in total, about 520 of them, sometimes as individuals and sometimes as big groups. What do we make of that claim? Well, as I've already alluded to, you have multiple independent witnesses to that thing happening. Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, the sources they use, Q, the source that we've lost but it was there somewhere, Paul and so on. You have multiple people talking about these events. In the case of Paul, still within the lifetime of people who were there as eyewitnesses. So in the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul talks about many who saw it have died, though some are still alive. AKA, you can go and ask them to verify that what I'm saying is true. Within that, you have a set of agreed details that kind of pair together like a jigsaw. As you read the histories, especially as you read the Gospels, you have a strange thing if someone's writing fiction, namely a whole lot of names that need to be separated out from each other. So Matthew, Mark, Luke and John talk about Mary, then they talk about the other Mary, then they talk about Mary the mother of James and Mary the mother of the Lord. They talk about Peter and John and Cephas. They talk about these people that need to be distinguished in people's minds. And they talk about people that appear nowhere else in history. Only of interest to the first generation, written by fussy people who want to get it right so that their friends don't make fun of them for the details that they got wrong. I want you to know that I know that that Mary wasn't the other Mary, the one that we all know was the mother of James. We don't know what they're talking about, but you can see them having an internal conversation to make sure they've got the details right. It's the same with the places. It talks about a garden tomb, about Bethany, about Galilee, about a meal in an upper room, and about a meeting. All this gratuitous information, which is nothing like Homer. It's nothing like the myths. It's about times and places and weird details about who got there first. You're told that the two, Peter and John, that went to the tomb, that John got there first. He was younger and a faster runner. Peter got there second but ran straight in because he was more impetuous and just wanted to see things for himself. You had details like the women, as they went to the tomb, are having this conversation about who's going to remove the stone, which you would have think would be an obvious thing to have talked about before you got there, because it's this massive stone that would take at least five men to move, and they haven't even thought about that, and yet they've got the spices and off they go. You get those details we talked about last week about the way the grave clothes are folded and set up and so on. The accounts you read, it would be so easy to describe them as just poetic religious imagination, but they don't read like that. As you look at them, they're actually full of detail and full of clarification. There were other gospels written by Christians very, very much later. There's one called the Gospel of Peter, which tries to do what none of the biblical accounts do, that is to describe the resurrection of Jesus itself. One of the weird parts of the biblical accounts is that no one actually describes the resurrection of Jesus, presumably because no one saw it. But later on, people wrote things, and the Gospel of Peter says this. He says that the stone which had been laid at the entrance rolled itself away and went to the side, and the sepulchre was opened, and both men entered. And the soldiers saw this, and they saw three men come out of the tomb, two of them sustaining the other, and a cross on them, and their heads reached to the heavens. The one that was led, his hands overpassed the heavens. And they heard a voice out of heaven saying, "Hast thou preached to them that sleep?" And from the cross the answer heard was, "Yea." Now, if you know the biblical accounts, that is very different from anything you read in the Bible. That is poetic religious imagination. Heads that reach up to heavens, talking crosses, and so on. Very different from the fussy little biblical accounts about who got there first and where they were and on which side the people were standing and so on. What you have when you boil down the literary and historical evidence is really two claims. That early in the morning, a tomb was found empty, and then over a period of 40 days, the man who had occupied that tomb appeared to people as having been raised from the dead. Those two things, it seems to me, are in no dispute in any source that we have. Christian or non-Christian, the agreement is that they believe themselves to have seen the risen Jesus, and they believe to have found that the tomb was empty. Now, of course, there are other possible explanations for what happened. For example, perhaps Jesus didn't really die on the cross, that he just got very sick and kind of went into a coma and was put in the tomb and revived. That's called the swoon theory. Maybe they went to the wrong tomb. It was early in the morning. And maybe they just got confused and that was the wrong tomb. And when the angel said, he's not here, see where they laid him. Maybe the angel was saying, see where they laid him, over there. Possible. Maybe someone stole the body. Maybe they hallucinated and saw Jesus afterwards in their grief. Maybe, as in Islam, it was someone else that was crucified and Jesus himself escaped. They're all possible explanations. But how likely are they? How likely is it, for example, that Jesus, having been killed by professional Roman executioners, revived in the tomb? After having been beaten all night, having been crucified, having had a spear stabbed into his side, how likely is it not only that 40 hours later, for some reason, early in the morning on Sunday is the time when he felt better, and he felt a lot better? Because somehow he's suddenly running around Jerusalem talking to people. He's not saying, I feel really rough. He is alive. How likely is that? How likely is it they mistook the tomb? Especially when, to quash Christianity, all you needed to do was for one of the Roman authorities to say, oh, wrong tomb, it's that one. Here's the body. How likely is it that they got the wrong tomb? Or how likely is it that someone stole the body? Why would they steal it? Why did they take the grave clothes off? If it was the disciples, why were they prepared to die for a hoax? Surely at the point where someone is about to crucify you upside down, you would say, do you know what? It was a joke. I don't really want this to happen. Or hallucinations. That does happen, certainly, for people in grief. Does it happen for 523 people in separate incidences and together? How likely is it that a delusion is that well spread across time and space and people? Or if it was someone else on the cross, well, that's a suggestion that comes 500 years after the events that we're talking about. Is it really likely that they got it wrong that close to the start? Now, I realize that we're doing or have done our time, and I didn't get quite to my conclusion, but I know that there are banks to run and mines to mine and shops to staff. Do you want me to give you a chance to escape, and then I've got another 5 minutes of things to say for those who can hang around? Is that the best way to do it?
Sounds all
right. Okay, I'll take no offence at all if you walk out. God bless you, we'd love to see you next week. Let me just bring this together. The early Christians claimed that Jesus had been raised from the dead. The necessary conditions for that claim are an empty tomb and a resurrection appearance. No one would use the language of resurrection for anything other than that. What we don't have is a documentation of how Jesus rose. There was no camera in there describing the process or anything. You have an empty tomb and you have resurrection appearances. The biblical scholar N.T. Wright describes the evidence like this. He says, for example, if I think I see an elephant walking past the Houses of Parliament, this is in England, and I assume that it's either a clever pantomime-like hoax or that I consumed much more alcohol last night than I realised. But if I then hear on the news that an elephant has gone missing from the circus in Hyde Park, it doesn't take me long to put those two events together. Or I'm going to put it this way. Imagine that you came up today and you saw Philippa running out of the room with a gun. And then you walked into the room and found Paul's body lying dead on the stage at the front. Now that's an unusual situation to find yourself in, and there's all sorts of other explanations you might look for. It doesn't seem likely that Philip would do that. It doesn't seem like Paul's the kind of guy that attracts hitmen from the mob, and so on. But those two things together lead you to at least take seriously the possibility that Philippa killed Paul. It's not incorrigible, and I don't think belief in the resurrection is incorrigible. You could always doubt it. Just like it could be that, unbeknownst to us, Philippa is a major fan of artillery. She loves guns, can't get enough of them, and today was the day to bring hers in to work. And on that very same day, the mob finally got Paul. It's possible. But the most likely explanation is that Philippa killed Paul, and it seems to me that the most likely explanation for what happened on the 7th of April, 33 AD, is the Christian claim that Jesus rose from the dead. As I say, that created as many problems for first century Jews as it did for first century Romans as it does for us today. No Christian is claiming that this kind of thing happens. No Christian is claiming that if under the right conditions, if you get the right size Jewish man, kill him in the right circumstances for the right period of time and put him in the right kind of tomb under the right conditions, this is what happens. It's not what happens, but the claim is that it's what happened. That one time, God did something that no one, Jewish or Gentile, was expecting. That he rose Jesus from the dead, and in doing so, radically changed the whole timetable that the Old Testament led us to expect for the work of God in the salvation of the world. Now, specifically what that means is what we want to come back to next week. Because many people have got as far as we've got today. Pincus LePage, the Jewish scholar, believes that Jesus rose from the dead. But he's not a Christian. So he has a different explanation for what it means. Next week I want to talk about what it means for Christians.